This is a recording of Lynn D. from Reno, Nevada, the Narnon Luncheon Speaker, taped at the First California Mid-State Regional Convention for NA in Fresno, California, on Saturday, June 30th, 1990. In observance with the 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all NA and Narnon speakers.
Great to see all of you here, and now I'd like to introduce our speaker. And it's Lynn D. from Reno. And let's give her a big welcome.
My name's Lynn. I'm a grateful Narnon. And the slogan for the convention is Narnon, a way of life, spirit, and unity. And I just wanted to comment on the unity. You have a real special Narnon going here and a real special NA. And I feel really glad in my heart to hear about the support that the NA and the love that you've felt from the NA people at this convention. And that's real special, real special. So I'd like to thank the NA for that. Let's see. The best way that I could tell you my story is just to tell you it all. And so for you to get to know me, you need to know that I was born into a upper middle class Jewish family. And you probably all hear the stories about Jewish mothers and guilt. So one of the first things I learned was how to manipulate. And one of the second things I learned was that you worry. That's just what you did. You didn't say what you needed. You didn't tell people how you felt, but you manipulated the situation to get what you wanted. And then all the rest of the time you were worrying about what could happen or what might happen or, you know, figments of your imagination of everything that possibly could be. I am the third child of four. My brother is a computer whiz, my sister is a doctor, and I am a substance abuse counselor. And my poor younger brother is the black sheep. So I think it was hard to come after the first two that I came after, but it must have been agony to come after all three of us, overachievers with, you know, specialty degrees. I had lots of girlfriends, close girlfriends in junior high and high school, and had close male friends that were just friends. But my girlfriend's mother would always say about how boy crazy I was. And I try to think back, if I was that boy crazy, how come I didn't have a bunch of boyfriends? But I do remember back that guys were a main focus in my life. And that probably was, you know, I watched a lot of TV and went to a lot of movies and believed in all that stuff about your prince will come along one day and make you whole and make you wonderful and everything would be beautiful. You know, give your power away and let other people make you feel better or worse, as the case may be. And I'm trying to remember back one of my first boyfriends. I had one in high school, and that didn't last too long because, actually, I don't know why, but I do know that he found someone else. And like my last semester in high school, you know, the prom was coming up. I was on the committee. We were planning it and everything, and who was I going to go with, you know? And since I was a wonderful planner and controller, you know, I helped my girlfriend go out with one of my best guy friends so that they were going to the prom together. But, you know, I had to go out on the patrol and find someone to go with me. So I found this guy at work, and he was older, and I thought he was wonderful looking, and he was real tall, and I thought, oh, well, I'll get him. So I manipulated the situation, but you know, we don't really have that much control, even though we think we do, and I didn't end up going to the prom. You know, he was too much older, too much taller, and he said, there's no way I'm going to high school prom. So we went out and had dinner. But that was the beginning of men and manipulation, I think. And as long as I try to control or manipulate other people, you know, I'm still giving my power away. But I had enough self-worth, I guess, back then, that when this fellow decided he was going to turn the tables and tell me how to dress and how tell me how to act, I said, later, you know, no one's going to do that to me. And so when I went off to college, and that happened, I thought, well, there's lots of guys here, I'll just look around and go out with a bunch of them. And at the end of my freshman year, I just started going out with one of my brother's friends that he had brought home a couple years ago to Thanksgiving, who I thought was, oh, Prince Charming. He had long blonde hair and he was really smart and he was a wonderful talker, and we started going out and he dumped me like hot potato after I went home for summer break, but I didn't know that. And I had conned my brother and my mother to allow me to go back up there to stay with my brother and to see this guy. And then wham in the face, this guy had dumped me. So there I was at my brother's house with his roommates. So what do? I look around and see who's eligible there. You know, they're having a party and, you know, I need a man, so I'll just pick one of these. And I guess I really was boy crazy. I'm afraid I still am. And I had met my brother's roommates before. The first time I met my addict, I had lost my bicycle at college, and when I went to go unlock it, the little metal key just broke right in it, so I needed someone to cut the lock. And my brother worked the maintenance at the university, and he sent this guy and him who came up to cut the lock for me. And I didn't think much of him. I looked at him. I thought, well, this is one of my brother's loady friends, you know. Okay, I won't, you know. So when I saw that, I thought, okay, well, he's not eligible anymore. We put him in a different category. And the next time I saw them, they were going to a concert, so they were getting stoned. And so I thought, yep, he's in that category for sure now. But see, once I was dumped by that other guy, all of a sudden he came back into the category of eligibles because I was on the prowl again. I'm talking about denial. So all of a sudden he looked real good. And we started spending time together that weekend. And we spent a lot of time together. And all of a sudden, you know, he fit real good into that story tale image of Prince Charming. You know, he listened to me. He talked to me. He got stoned and drunk the whole time we were together, but that was okay because, you know, that was weekend party behavior. That was my rationale. More denial. But he was wonderful. When I came home and I told my girlfriends that summer, I had met my soulmate. And just totally ignored all the other facts in his life and in my life. And when I moved back up to go to school, to go to college, the next year, we spent almost that whole year together, either at my house or at his house. And slowly the reality of the situation that he was drinking every day, or let's say every other day, but that he was smoking pot when he got up in the morning, and he was smoking pot at lunch, and I was smoking pot when I got home, and that he slowly told me a little bit about his drug history, and I started pushing him to get help. Push, push, push. You need help. And he's all, no, I don't. You know, I have it under control. I don't have a problem. I'm not an addict. And slowly but surely, that became the focus of my thinking, was that he needed help, that he was an addict, and that I was going to help him get into help. And all the time I'm studying sociology and psychology in school, and I'm learning all about alcoholism and addiction, and I'm working on the community hotline helping these other people, you know, but I couldn't help my own. And part of one of my classes was to go to Al-Anon and to go to AA meetings to see what it was we were learning about or talking about. and I love the Al-Anon meetings. So we were supposed to go to 3, I think it was, and I went to a couple more. But what kept me apart was that this was just for school. You know, I'm not one of them. You know, I don't really need that. But I really liked the way I felt in the room. And at the time, there was no Narnon in Santa Barbara. And I pushed so much that one day he said, okay, I'll go. And we had a friend who had gone into treatment down in Los Angeles. So we were setting up for him to go down to Los Angeles to go to treatment and talk to the lady on the phone about what the rules were, because back then they were real strict about you couldn't see the person for a week, and then when you did see him, you had to go to group with them, and we were setting up all the rules, and she asked me how much I knew about him, how much I knew about his drug addiction, and I said, well, that I knew he drank, and I knew he smoked pot, and I knew he snorted cocaine, and I knew that he had done everything except shoot up. And she said, honey, if you think that, you're sorely mistaken. And that was a real slap in the face. You know, here I have been fighting this denial. He doesn't need help. He does need help. He isn't an addict. He is an addict. And then here she gave it to me straight in the face. Not only is he an addict, but he's a real addict. A real drug addict. So I stormed down to his house to tell him, you know, why'd you lie to me, and how could you have done this, and you have to go into treatment right away. And he's all, okay. And that Monday, I drove him down to Los Angeles, and he was going to get well. And I had this terrible guilt feeling. Here I was locking him up. Somehow it was my fault. He was a drug addict. He had been using for 15 years before I ever met him, but somehow it was my fault because I was taking him to treatment, and he was going to be locked in there. And I called to find out exactly where the meeting was, and I was told that the following Monday he wasn't going to be allowed out. The doctor hadn't cleared him. He was too sick. But I didn't hear that. All I heard was that you're not going to be able to see him. And he somehow found out that I was on the phone, and they were telling me I couldn't come see him. And he knew, I guess, he knew how I felt, and he knew how he felt about not seeing me, and he left right away and calls me up and says, there's no way that I could live without you. I mean, what a hook. Someone needs me that much. He can't live without me. Yes, I'll come get you. No, you don't have to go to the Connections house in Los Angeles. So I drag him back to my girlfriend's house, her folks' house. And here we are sitting around with a person who's only half detoxed. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but we went out to dinner, and he's standing up and he's sitting down, and he's standing up and he's sitting down, and he's walking around, and he's irrational. And then we went to a movie, and this is embarrassing. We didn't sit in the front. We sat in the back seat, if you know what I mean. And my girlfriend tells me, she asked when the movie was all over, if we would be more comfortable at home in Santa Barbara than here. And we didn't hear that, okay? And especially my addict did not hear that. He heard, get out and leave now. So I took on his feelings of rejection and hurt, and we left, and that was the last time I talked to that girlfriend for a long time. So that this disease not only was destroying my personality, but it was also destroying my friend. And for a long time, I blamed it on him. That wasn't my responsibility either. That was his fault. I lost that girlfriend. And his disease got worse and worse and worse. And walked in on him using once. And he had me out of the room, and trying to convince me I hadn't seen what I had saw. And my denial was so strong that I started buying into it. And all I knew was that I was changing. And we were living together by then, and if you walked into our house and said, who is sick here? You would obviously point to me, because my personality had gotten so warped in trying to control that I was a raging bitch. I was. You know, he was just laid back nodding. So I knew that I had to get out of this situation, and I loved him. He was a wonderful person. Wonderful. Everyone who ever met him loved him. He just had a wonderful spirit inside. He was real kind and real giving and real loving. And I could not tolerate his drug addiction. I could not tolerate his using. And I got as sick as he did. And I decided the only way to break from this man was to move out of town when I graduated. But you don't get forwarding addresses and phone numbers when you break up. And I mean, he knew where I was going. He had the phone number. He had the address. And with a BA in sociology, you're not very employable. I didn't know that at the time. And I decided I needed to go back to school and get a degree, a master's degree. And I had known the schools in Santa Barbara, and I didn't know the schools other places. And I knew that I wanted to get a master's degree in counseling, and that I wanted to be employable as soon as I graduated or before. And I knew that there were lots of jobs in substance abuse. And since that was my area already, that's what I was going to go into. And I had been going to college to go into counseling from the beginning. You know, it was either going to be psychology, or it was going to be accounting. And you had to take too many economics classes, and I failed my first class in college, and it was economics. So I knew I wasn't going to do 9 economics classes just to be an accountant. So I went back to Santa Barbara and lived with a woman where he could not call and he could not come see me. And I tore the cartilage in my knee, and I had to have surgery, and I called him because that bond was still there, that connectedness was still there, and I was frightened about having surgery. And he came, visited me, and he came right after I got out of surgery, and it was the first time I was more loaded than he was. And I have no idea what I said. I was right out of surgery. And then I went home, and he went to his house. And shortly thereafter, I knew something was wrong. Even though I don't think we had spent any time together in the 3 months before, I knew something was up. And I called his house, and they said he had gone to San Francisco for vacation. And I knew he was either dead or in treatment. So I called the treatment center up, and, you know, they say I can't release any information, federal law. And I said, okay, well, can I write? Or could he write? And they said, well, we can't tell you if they're here or not, but if they are, we'll pin a message, and, you know, they'll get back to you if they are. But we can't tell you if they are or not. And I got a letter the following day or two saying that he was in treatment. And it was like, all right, he's finally done what I always wanted him to do. And I had gone to enough Al-Anon meetings to know that I had changed and that I had been affected, and that I wanted to support him in his recovery, and if he is paying for this recovery, I might as well get some too. You know, he's paying for it. So I went to the hospital, and I remember this real, real strongly. I was frightened, really, really frightened, because I knew the condition I had left him in. He had gone from heroin on to methadone, and he was using on top of methadone. And he was 6'4 and 155 pounds, and I was scared about what I was going to see if he really was half dead. And I went into the hospital, and the counselor grilled me. And I was like, how dare you? I'm not the sick one. He's the sick one. He's the one in the hospital. I just came to support him. Oh, I was righteous. And they wanted to know what I was doing there. If I was broken up with them, why was I there? You know? So in that kind of fear situation, it was like glob back onto them right away. But that something good came out of that was that I did go through their program, and I did go to Al-Anon, and I heard something about Al-Anon. And I was in an Al-Anon speaker meeting, and I turned to the little person next to me, and I said, have you heard anything about this Narcanon? She says, it's Narnon, honey, and I'm the secretary. You know, it's just amazing how that happened. And I started going to Narnon every week. And it was real hard because when he got out of the hospital, sometimes he would go and sometimes he wouldn't go, and sometimes he'd get loaded and sometimes he'd stay straight. And by Thanksgiving, I had a Narnon sponsor. He had a NA sponsor. And I had invited all the people he had gone through treatment with, the people he was real close to, and my sponsor and his sponsor over for Thanksgiving dinner. And he came home loaded. And the only reason why I didn't take that carving knife and stab him to death, I was so angry. All that anger from before, I mean, I'd go to Narnon and I'd look good and I'd say good stuff, but it wasn't getting in because I was that ill. The only reason why he didn't die that night was because his sponsor took him off to a meeting and my sponsor took me off to a meeting. And I was so grateful to have that kind of support. And I was so grateful to be told that there was another way to live. First of all, the rule about manipulating was out. You had to talk about how you felt. And when you were angry, you said you were angry. When you were hurt, you said you were hurt. And when you wanted something, you asked for it. And the other thing I learned was that rule about worrying, that was a mistake. Okay, I'll take this stuff in. Now what do I do with it? And here I spend all this time worrying. How do you get rid of that? I mean, if you spend 80% of your time worrying, what are you going to put in that 80%? So slowly I memorized all the steps, and I memorized the Serenity Prayer, and I just put new tapes in my head when the worrying started coming up. And sometimes that worked and sometimes that didn't. Sometimes I caught myself, oh, I'm doing that again, and I could put in program. And other times it slipped by and I was worrying for a while. And then I got better and better at it, and I could identify that I was worrying about something that may never come to pass sooner, and was able to put program slogans and beliefs into my head rather than this old sick stuff. And slowly I was taught that my higher power was mine. You know, it wasn't something my parents had taught me, or something that, you know, you guys believed or someone else believed. Because I was real frightened about that in the program, because I thought, well, is it a Christian-based program? Because you won't want me if it's a Christian-based program, and I can't join if it is, you know, and I can't believe it if it is. So it was real nice to learn that it was a higher power as you understand him. But that also I was taught that if my program was going to work, that I needed to use it and that I needed to get in touch with that higher power. And slowly, instead of just doing lip service to the program when I went to meetings, I mean, this took a couple of years, I started working the program in my life. And my addict was, I thought, clean for a year off drugs and 6 months off alcohol, and we were going to get married. Because this man was my soulmate. And I came home one day. The invitations were printed but not sent. The wedding dress was bought. All the plans were made and ready. And I came home one day to find him shooting up. And because I had learned in this program that I didn't have to live that way anymore, and that I saw what I saw, that I could make choices. And finally, after almost 5 years of choosing to be with him and to stay with him no matter what, except for that 3 months when we were broken up, I decided that I could no longer live this way, and we weren't going to live together anymore, and we weren't going to get married anymore. And that was real hard. All those dreams, you know, because he was still that guy in the movies, and we were going to get married and live happily ever after. And I had to look at that. You know, this is reality now. But I had been taught in this program a lot of things. And so I started really working the program and using the things that I had been taught, like praying every day for God's will for me and the power to carry that out, and that I was no longer in control. But I had a little problem letting go of that. So it was like, okay, God, I'm not in control. And I wasn't so easy in letting go of that. So, okay, God, you take it. I could give it to someone else. If I give something to someone else, I don't have to take it back. So I had to do that every day. So every day I prayed for God's will for me and the power to carry that out, and for God to be responsible for him, because I couldn't be. And every day I did that, and every night I thank God for doing a good job. And slowly, things got a lot better in my life. You know, I was living my life for myself. I was working, and I was, you know, making contact with my friends, and I was really enjoying myself. And I even just started to date other men. But I wasn't well. I wasn't perfect. And I'd continue to see my addict every Sunday. We'd go to the movies or we'd go to breakfast or whatever. And then this one weekend I said, you know, I started dating other men, and I said that I wasn't going to be in town that weekend, that I was going to Los Angeles. My girlfriend's father was dying of cancer, and I needed to say goodbye. And thank God, through this program, I had already made my amends to my other girlfriend and took responsibility for that. I cut her off, you know, that she had written, and I had cut her off, and that I apologized for doing that, and that could we be friends again. So luckily I had that girlfriend back in my life, and I was going to say goodbye to my other girlfriend's father. And I came back to town, and by then I was working at the hospital that my addict had gone through. I was getting paid by then, I think. Yeah, I wasn't an intern anymore. And his counselor came in, and it was a Saturday or a Sunday, and I was supposed to be working, and why was he here? You know, you don't come in on your days off. And he asked to talk to me, and he said, they found John in Isla Vista. And I thought, well, you know, I had learned that the whole world isn't just my John, and that there are other Johns in the world, and that meant, since we were at work, that meant John G. that I worked with. And I thought, well, why is he telling me this? And then he said, and he's dead. And I thought, you're talking about my John, and you're talking to that my John is dead. And I said, he died from drugs, didn't he? And he said, yeah. And because of this program, I felt relief that his suffering was over, that he couldn't make this program. He had no concept of a higher power, that his life was as it was. He wanted to get clean, and he couldn't get clean, and he was suffering. And I felt relief. I felt real sad because my best friend of 5 years was dead. The person I had shared all that with was dead. But because of this program, I didn't have to die. And that if he had died that 6 months earlier, when I caught him shooting up, I probably would have killed myself, because he was still my world. But because it had been 6 months of really working this program, taking this step, daily meditation, I grieved, but I didn't have to die. I wasn't him anymore. I was myself. I had my own spirit back. And then I was afraid, because I was in Naranon. I got into Naranon because of him, and that our friends were all Naranon and NA, that I wasn't going to have anyone anymore, because he had been the person who had helped me get here, and he was gone. But it was the people in NA and Naranon that came to support me. It was their love and their sharing of their higher power when I was real angry that got me through. And that, I think, got me onto a different level, you know. Because they really did, when I was saying, you know, how can you tell me God gives you no more than you can handle, and I feel like I can't handle this anymore. How can you tell me that? But they were always there to support me and to get me through that spot. And they were real loving and real kind. And I can never repay them for that. Except for that every time someone asked me to do something for Naranon is to say yes, and then figure out later how I can do it. to do the 12 steps, you know, to bring the message to other people. And that girlfriend whose father was dying, and I had planned to go on a cruise from, you know, we were celebrating graduating, and he had died, John died a month before the cruise. The tickets were all paid for, it had all been planned, and couldn't get it back. So we went. And I remember on the way home thinking, he's not going to be there to pick me up from the airport. I mean, he was a constant in my life. He was a real strong support. And I'm going to be flying back into Los Angeles, and he's not going to be there. And I pulled the blanket. We had lots of room, and I had been lying down. And I pulled the blanket over my head and sobbed. I'm all alone in this world. And God spoke to me and said, as long as you have this program, and as long as you talk to me, you will never be alone. I will always be here. And any time when I'm real, real frightened or real angry, any time I start worrying or start projecting into the future, I start praying again. And it works. It always works. It might take a little longer, or it might even take getting down on my knees, but it works. Every time, he's always been there. I decided, I had read enough in school that you don't do anything, and the program tells you don't do anything for a year, and it had already been my second year in the program, but I knew that I don't do anything for a year because I need to mourn this person. And to be real honest, I didn't always use the program and the people and my higher power when I felt that pain of loss. I went back to my old ways of where can I find a man who's going to fix this for me. And my sponsor and my now husband sponsor were afraid that I was going to sleep my way through NA. And I tried. And I don't regret it a minute. And all those people, except one, still have their original sobriety date and are still my friend. And I had nothing to do with that other person who doesn't have his original sobriety date. That wasn't me. That was him. So I stayed in Santa Barbara for a year and continued in Naranon and continued to go to conventions and share what I knew, and continue to listen to other people when they talked. Not always. Obviously, my sponsor said, stop sleeping with everyone, and I didn't listen. But after a year, I decided, okay, Santa Barbara's been a real safe place for me. My program's here. My friends are here. You know, it's real safe, but I can't afford it anymore. My work has been cut down from 40 hours to 20 hours, and you can't live in Santa Barbara on 20 hours. Plus, I was driving to Ventura to work, so that added expense. I just couldn't continue. And I guess I needed to move out of my safe environment. And when my husband's sponsor heard that I was moving out of Santa Barbara, he asked if I would come up to Reno to start Naranon there. And I said, yeah, I would. First, I had to visit some of the people that I had met at conventions, so I went around California going to some meetings. And then I went up to Grass Valley where my folks lived and commuted from Grass Valley to Reno to start Naranon. And it felt real good to be able to bring the message to a place where there weren't other Naranon meetings or anything. And there's a real, real big NA there. And my husband's sponsor jokingly said that I could have any pick of the men in the house. And his sister I worked with as a counselor in Santa Barbara, and she told him, you don't say that to Lynn. You know, I was not being a counselor at the time. I was bringing the message of Naranon to Reno. So I did. I took my pick of the men in the house. And I picked the one that I thought was, actually, I don't think I thought about if he was the wellest or not. All I did was I picked him because he didn't quote the big book all the time. You know how newcomers are. And he could have a conversation with me. And I remember on the year of John's death, it was real hard, and I had met friends in NA in Reno, and I shared my story with another woman in NA in Reno, and she was real, real supportive. And Mike, my husband now, he would let me talk about him, and he didn't seem to be jealous or anything. It was, he understood and was okay. That was real neat. And slowly I decided that I could not continue to commute from Grass Valley to Reno. Besides living with my folks, it was driving me crazy. And I decided, okay, well, I don't have a job where I wanted to have a job in, like, Sonoma, Napa Valley. I'll move to Reno and see what kind of jobs are there. And in the meantime, I went down to Santa Barbara to go to my boss's retirement party and was calling Mike, my husband, up in Reno at the halfway house, you know, to stay in contact with him. When I first met him, I jokingly said I picked him, you know, what man I wanted in the house. We were just friends. And we were spending time together because he had broken his ankle and he was off work. And I thought, this is really neat that I have a new friend in Reno. You know, something might happen more, something may not, but it was neat. And then something more happened, so it was even neater. And I was calling him when I was down in Santa Barbara, and one day I knew something was up, and before that I knew I had this inkling that he was drinking. And I thought, okay, I know this one. I know we left. But I don't have to buy into it anymore. I had learned that in this program, that your program is your program, and it's none of my business. I mean, the first time my sponsor said that to me, I wanted to slap her face. I mean, it's none of my business. But I had learned that, and I finally understood it, and I had internalized it. And I thought, well, if you want to drink and you want to kill yourself, go ahead. I'll still be friends with you. I don't have to get emotional over it. I'll call you and I'll stay in touch. And that's so neat to know that you are, that your program really works, that you're working it, and that you don't have to have that turmoil inside because no one's using. It's their stuff. That's not your stuff. And you can still stay happy and calm and peaceful. So nice. And he says that I got drunk, and I said, yeah, I figured something like that would happen. He was on probation, and he didn't get arrested. He got pulled over in front of the halfway house drunk. He was on probation. He had two loaded guns, and he had 23 open containers in the car. He had been sipping for a while, but I don't know how much he drank that weekend. I said, oh, so you're going to prison? And he said, no, the police led him off into his sponsor, my friend's custody, and that he was going to go see his probation officer tomorrow. But why didn't I say anything to him about his drinking? Why hadn't I told anyone, and why hadn't I confronted him about it? You know, it's like, no, that's all your fault. I thought, hey, that's your problem, that's your business, that's not mine. And I was like, I'm not buying into this either. And he was pissed off. So I came back to Santa Barbara, and his sponsor's wife, I don't know if his sponsor did or not, but his sponsor's wife had bought into his sick thinking about how it was my fault since I was a counselor and I didn't confront him and blah, 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 blah. I said, hey, I'm not getting paid. I'm not your counselor. It's none of my business. You have your program and I have my program. And if you want to come to my meetings and learn about my program, you can. And to his sponsor's wife and to his sponsor, I said, please come back to my meetings and I'll show you again. This is my program, and this is why I'm doing this, and I am doing it right. And they went, oh yeah, Narnon, Al-Anon, that's right, your program is your program, their program's none of my business. So I reverted back a little bit to my old behavior in that he went to treatment and I visited him a lot. We met secretly. You know how to do that when you're a counselor. So, you know, I'm not, well, I'm not perfect. So he always remembers this one thing, and so I might as well tell you that, or he'll tell you it to embarrass me. We were meeting, but it was one of those times when you were allowed to. And we were sitting by the river, the Truckee River, in front of the treatment center. And purple lavender Harley drove by. And he jokingly said something about, well, when are you going to buy me one? And I jokingly said, when you say, I do and I will. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, I do as in I will marry you, and I will as in have children. So I was real upfront and honest. And he always likes to tell people that. Here I was in treatment, and here she's saying this stuff to me. Hey, but I'm working my program, and I'm happy. And I'm being honest, and I'm telling my feelings, and I'm not manipulating. And I thought he was going to go back to the halfway house. I thought he had to go back to the halfway house because of his probation. But I had rented an apartment that I could afford in Reno. Reno's real cheap compared to Santa Barbara. And he decided he wanted to move in with me rather than go back to the halfway house. And I said, okay. Now, as long as you work your program, and I'll work my program. And I think that's a real key to our relationship, is that we do both work a program. And I remember one time he was going to work, and all of a sudden I was consumed by fear out of nowhere. He's going out there, and he's going to use today. And he's going to die just like John did. And I was just consumed by fear. And I got down on my hands and knees, and I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed. And God took that fear. And I was okay with it. I had no reason to believe that my husband was using. At the time, we weren't married, but I had no reason to believe that. He was going to 90 meetings in 90 days, and then his probation officer said, you know, you have to go to a meeting every day for a year, so that's what he was doing. What I didn't know was that every time I went back to Santa Barbara, like every three months or 6 months to visit, he'd drink, or he'd smoke, or he'd snort. But because by the time I got back, he was right, you know, and he was going to his meetings and everything. I knew nothing about it, absolutely nothing. And I didn't have that all-consuming fear, I know he's using ever again. I didn't have that. Every once in a while when he got home late from work, I thought, what happens if he had a drink or he's out drinking? He's dead on the highway. And then I thought, okay, that's that old thinking I was taught. I don't have to think that way anymore. He's going to come home or whatever, you know, and just prayed, put different thoughts in my head again. Well, one day I went to Santa Barbara, and when I came back, by then we had bought a house together, and in 3 months we were to get married, and I came back to find him drunk, which was real, real frightening to me, because the last time, you know, when I was in Santa Barbara and he was blaming me on his drunk, he had had a seizure, and he was a real low bottom drunk in health-wise. You know, the end of the line for alcoholism and drug addiction is seizures and delusions and hallucinations and all that. And he was having all that. He had done all that, you know. So how could he drink again, you know? So their fear called up again, you know, he's going to die. And it's real ironic that you asked me to speak this weekend, because it was 5 years ago yesterday that John died. So it's like there's always a full circle. And I came home to find him drunk, kind of passed out on the bed. You know, I didn't know what he was like drunk. I had never seen him drunk. I never seen him loaded. Well, he decided that he had to go out and get another drink. And I was afraid that he needed another drink or he was going to have a seizure on me. And I was afraid to let him go get another drink, because he was going to drive, and then it would be his fourth DUI, and then Nevada, the third is prison, but he had had his third in California, so he hadn't caught it. And I was going to lose my house, and I was going to lose him because he'd kill someone or kill himself. Then I decided, my program teaches me I have choices. What is my choice? What are my choices here today? And I decided, well, I'm no longer willing to pay for someone else's addiction. You know, that green leaflet talks about our compassion and living with an addict, and us taking on the addict's pain, and us thinking something's love when it's really, you know, not loving. And I decided, okay, I do not have to pay for his alcoholism or addiction, and that I'm not willing to pay for it. And if he wants a drink, he could walk, but he is not getting in that car. So he decided he was getting in that car. So what did I do? I went next door and got the neighbor. He was bigger than I am. He was bigger than he is, and he happens to be a highway patrolman. So my husband fought cop. Big cop. You know, here he was about to go out the door to get in the car, and I thought, no, I'm not willing to pay for this. So I went and got the cop. He opens the door, and there he is, big cop. And our next door neighbor said, look, I'm not here as an officer. I'm here as a friend. Why don't we take a walk instead? Thank God, he had just gotten home from wherever he was, and he was there right at that second to take a walk with him. And somehow that was enough to break that obsession to get that drink, that when they came back from the walk, it was drizzling out. He agreed with me that I could take him over to his sponsor's house. I'm not a big enough fool to think that I can take care of him when he's drunk, or to keep him from getting that drink if he decides he wants it again. And I'm not willing, there's my choice, I'm not willing to pay for his addiction or alcoholism or the consequences of it. So I went to take him over to his sponsor's house, which is ironically my ex-dead addict sponsor was also his sponsor. And he wasn't home, so we just sat on his doorstep waiting for him to come home. And he got home and I was shaking. And I was crying on his wife's shoulder. She's in the program, and I kept saying, how could this be happening to me again? I can't lose another one. Please don't let him die. You have to help him. You're his sponsor. You do his program. I can't. And she said, look, he is not John. Don't make him John. And it was like, oh yeah, that's my program. Okay. So I got back into that spirituality, and it's real nice that how Narnon and NA complement themselves, and that we can be there for each other, and that that both programs have always been there for me. And by the grace of God, my husband has not had to have a drink, pill, wine, snort, fix. He didn't do that, but whatever. Since then. Just 3 years ago in May. And our lives have changed drastically since then. I mean, we did get married, and a year ago, this coming September, we had a baby boy who's absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And God willing, he's being brought up in a house where there's a program where he could be taught self-respect, self-love, how to be assertive, not to be manipulative, that he doesn't have to worry, and that there's a loving higher power out there that he can always turn to. When I hear other people in meetings talk about their child who's an addict, I still have that fear come up for a second, and then I have to remind myself he's not even a year yet. That's a little bit projecting there, you know, come back to earth. Work your program and it'll all be okay. It's a real pleasure to be here and to be in meetings again. I was the secretary of the Reno meeting for 3 years, and towards the end of my pregnancy and when Jeffrey was born, I couldn't do it anymore. And because I didn't have the support and the love that you all have here, that was the end of our Reno meeting. And I had tried to get the fellowship, like the fellowship was going in Carson City, so I'd try to go there, and they had dropped their meeting. And I tried to go to Lake Tahoe, and they had dropped their meeting. And I knew I couldn't do it anymore. You know, I could not do it alone. And that if there wasn't the need or the support that I needed right then, I couldn't do it, and that it would be okay to drop the meeting. And so the only meetings that I get to Narnon anymore is when I come to conventions, or when I go to Santa Barbara or San Diego to visit, you know. So it's been a real pleasure to be here with all of you and to feel the love and support in your program and in NA. And I just really want to thank you for being here for me. Thank you.